Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real pleasure to welcome to this O'Leary Report Mary Holland, who is the Vice Chairman and General Counsel of the Children's Health Defense. She has a very impressive resume. She's a former research scholar and director at the Graduate Lawing Program at the NYU School of Law. She taught at Columbia Law, worked in international public and private law after clerking for a federal district judge in the Southern District of New York. She has written extensively on vaccine law and policy and is the co-author and co-editor of two books, Vaccine Epidemic and HPV Vaccine on Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed. She has testified to retain or expand vaccine exemptions in California, West Virginia, Maine, and Vermont legislatures. She's appeared in several documentaries and programs on vaccine issues. She's chair of the Advisory Board of Health Choice and a member of the advisory boards for the Elizabeth Burt Center for Autism Law and Advocacy, the Otto Sprecht School, and Action Play. I want to give special thanks to a very special subscriber who is knowledgeable in this area and made it possible for us to arrange this O'Leary Report. If you look at what Children's Health Defense is doing, they are the diamond drill bit of trying to make things go right in this area. Before I bring Mary in, I just want to read a quote I found from her recently that I just love. She says, "Once I learned about the extreme liability protection that industry and healthcare providers enjoy and the suppression of accurate science and information about vaccine risks and injury, I understood the need for immediate, radical, systemic change. I have been devoted to that change ever since." So, Mary Holland, thank you so much for joining us on the O'Leary Report.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
It's perfect. Immediate, radical, systemic change. I couldn't agree with you more. So,
and I've forgotten that quote candidly, but yes, I still and wholeheartedly endorse that. And it's possible that I said that as long as 20 years ago. So
really?
This is a serious problem that's, only getting worse. I've been involved in this area for about 20 years.
Uh-huh.
Well, about 20 years. And, frankly, there's been a movement around no mandates and around individual choice around vaccines, literally since they were first introduced in the United Kingdom, if not before, when Edward Jenner came up with the cowpox solution for smallpox. It ended up there being riots in the UK, and that's where the word conscientious objection comes from.
Right,
it's
I remember
from smallpox
that.
Mandates for children. So this is not a new issue, but because the vaccine schedule globally, and particularly in the United States, has become so frequent and such a burden on, infants and young children and children, although there's plans to expand it to all adults, but it's so burdensome that this issue has become much, much, much more intense.
Wait, so tell us the history of vaccine exemptions in the United States. What is the history, and then talk about the mandates and why it's under assault?
Yeah, sure, I'm happy to. So in smallpox was a very serious infectious disease in the 1700s and 1800s in the United States. When it would sort of go through as a wave, it was a respiratory illness and people would die. Not, every other person, but, it was a significant death toll and a permanent disability toll. And so already in the 1700s, there were questions about mandates. And, it's sort of the law would go in either direction, and it was more or less handled at local levels. But the landmark case for mandates is a 1905 case called Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And the U.S. Supreme Court decided, there was no written dissent, although there was one dissenter. There was they decided, yes, a state in the context of imminent harm from infectious disease that has gone through the legislature by law and that does not discriminate against any particular group without basis, can be upheld so long as There are medical exemptions where vaccinating somebody would be cruel to the ultimate extent, i.e. would be likely to cause severe injury or death. So in 1905, they said mandates are okay. And then a little bit more troublingly, in 1923, without any real rationalization, a case came back to the U.S. Supreme Court that said, well, can we have a preemptive mandate for children in school against smallpox? And really, without much reasoning, the court said, yeah, based on Jacobson, no problem. We're going to let you have mandates for schools, preemptive mandates, again, for smallpox. So that was kind of where things rested. But in the 50s and the 60s, we started to see a major ramp up of vaccines. We started to see not only a polio vaccine in the 50s, but then measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis by the 60s, and that they were widespread. And by then, the legal infrastructure was in place that states could mandate this stuff and require it. And so, Catherine, 48 states starting in the 60s said, you know, that goes too far. It's a bridge too far. There are religions that overtly say no vaccination, like Christian Science and like Jehovah's Witness, no intervention with the blood, nothing in the body. But there are other people who just say, you know, that's just not my religion. I just don't believe that's the way to prevent disease. So 48 states until very recently had religious exemptions, and at its heyday, about 20 states had what were called philosophical exemptions, meaning you could say no for any reason. It didn't have to be a religious reason. And in the last 10 years, as this issue has become more hot, more and more people have been asserting exemptions. And I think the pharmaceutical industry, frankly, kind of sees the writing on the wall. And so really starting in 2015 and a little bit before that, the seed was planted in California to get rid of religious and philosophical exemptions. And so there has been a concerted, massive effort since 2015 by the pharmaceutical industry and by the medical associations and medical institutions and front groups essentially for the vaccine program, like Vaccinate Your Family or the Immunization Action Coalition, to take away what they call quote-unquote non-medical exemptions throughout the country. So that's already happened in California. It's happened in Maine, although it hasn't taken effect yet in Maine, and it's already happened in New York. That means religious or philosophical, but the most frightening thing, Catherine, is when they say they're taking away non-medical exemptions, what has happened in California and New York, and California and New York, California and Maine haven't fully gone into effect yet. But what they really mean by that is de facto they're taking away medical exemptions too. And what they've put in place in New York, where I'm in New York, and so I know New York best, there were some emergency guidelines that the Department of Health adopted in August 2019 that became permanent on December 31st, 2019. And those guidelines say the only basis for a medical exemption if somebody has anaphylaxis, i.e. they can't breathe and they nearly die, or they have documented brain injury. And even in those cases, that would be an exemption for that specific vaccine. Let's say for a DPT shot, it would not exempt you from a meningitis vaccine. So de facto, medical exemptions by treating physicians in New York are now reviewable by the Department of Health. And the Department of Health, through a bureaucrat who has never examined a particular child, may say, no, I disagree with the neurologist who says that this child is at risk of brain injury from the next vaccine. I deny their exemption. And so we have hundreds of children in New York State whose treating physicians have said there is a medical necessity that they not be vaccinated, and yet the state has said, no, you have to vaccinate. No normal, loving, responsible parent will put their child in harm's way that way. And I believe, and we're seeing some evidence of this, thankfully, that's really not even what the precedent says. Jacobson versus Massachusetts over 100 years ago says you cannot vaccinate an individual where it would be cruel to the ultimate extent to do that. And so we've gotten two wins so far in New York State of children with special needs who are being denied their medical exemptions. And in both cases, judges have reinstated. There's actually three cases right now in New York, and there will be future cases around this issue. And there's also, very interestingly, a bill in New York to take away this notion that non-treating physicians can review a medical exemption and deny it. There's a bill that's been introduced in the Senate in New York, and we expect a companion bill in the Assembly, and we're hopeful that this session, we will go back to the precedent that says you must have a medical exemption for people who are at real risk of being injured. But in my view, after World War II, when the world adopted a standard that said there can be no experimentation on humans without prior free and informed consent, which means you have legal capacity. It means there could be no duress, no fraud, no coercion. That should have ended mandates globally for vaccines and for everything else. Right. And since that time in 1945, there's been an expansion from just experimentation to treatment. And so the UNESCO Declaration of 2005 says that you have to have informed consent for preventive medical interventions. That means you have the right to say no. Consent means you have the right to say no. And many advanced countries with excellent health metrics, Japan, Scandinavia, Germany, up until recently, Spain, other countries, they have no mandates. UK, they have recommendations, but they have no mandates. And what we're starting to see now, not only in the United States in this trend toward mandates, but globally, we're seeing this greater level of coercion. And my reading of human rights law and of US law is that this is unlawful, because we have adopted as the hallmark of modern medicine prior free and informed consent. And that means you have right. to have legal capacity, and you have to have the right to say no. And we're seeing erosion of both of those things, that it's free consent and erosion that you have to have legal capacity. And we can talk more about that.
Well, I remember in high school having literally the Nuremberg Code kind of beaten into us. And, you know, we were really taught to believe that a society that would violate those was abhorrent, shocking, appalling. And mm-hmm. what has most amazed me about some of the vaccination policies and the mandates is the extent to which we seem to have just sailed across that line without thought or discussion. And I can't, it's hard for me to fathom that.
I'm with you, Catherine. It's hard to fathom. It's very clear to anybody with a moment's thought and reading about this that these are extremely serious medical interventions, all of which carry the potential risk of death. They like to say that the risk is 1 in 1,000,000. There's no evidence for that. The risks are far higher than that. But all you have to do is, on the internet, look up a product insert for a polio vaccine or for a right. diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis. I mean, there's, 50 different medical conditions, typically including death, that are listed on the product insert. And so the propaganda rolls on. Vaccines are safe and effective. Vaccines are safe and effective. But, when you look for evidence of this, it's just not true. I mean, all you have to do is look at what the manufacturers say to ensure that they continue to be liability free. We should talk about that. They list the things that people report to them are adverse events after vaccination with this vaccine. Now, they go to great lengths to say this isn't proven and we never go back and test and this is a sample size of unknown number, but these are reported adverse events from this vaccine. I don't know how you can say that somebody shouldn't have the right to say, no, I'll take my risks. I'd really rather get the mumps than die. I mean, it's just, right. it's silly. It's just silly. I mean, this whole debate on a certain level is just so silly, because obviously the reason that in 1986, Congress passed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act to protect manufacturers from liability is because people were being severely injured, and some of them were winning large judgments against manufacturers. So right. commonsensically, you'd say, gee, we really need to make vaccines safer, rather than, gee, we really need to give manufacturers liability protection so they can keep making dangerous vaccines. But what happened, and so there's language in the 1986 Act, we're going to give liability protection to the doctors, we're going to give liability protection to the manufacturers, but they must make vaccines safer, and they must come and report to Congress every 2 years about how they're making vaccines safer. Guess what? Have they ever come to Congress to tell them how they're making vaccines safer? Not once. And that we have a judicial decision on that, showing there's a judicial notice that the manufacturers have never come to Congress to report how they're safer. And indeed, I think there's some very good empirical work. There's a wonderful economist slash statistician, Gail DeLong, who's done a study called Delitigation. And she shows, based on the available data, that those vaccines that have been added to the federally recommended schedule for children since 1986 have a higher reported injury rate than those vaccines that were adopted before delitigation.
I don't know if you watched the vaccine summit that was in Switzerland in December.
I've watched significant parts, not the whole thing, but it was
I only watched a, you know, sort of excerpts. I'd say I watched it maybe an hour, so I'm sure you saw more. But what I saw was that not only was the pushback coming from the medical practitioners and the parents, but you had people with program responsibilities in the different countries pointing out that there was no safety studies for. I remember, I think there was a fellow from Nigeria basically said, you know, there's no safety studies to say that once you put all these different vaccines in one small little body, that that cocktail is safe.
Correct. It's an extraordinary summit that if you go to the World Health Organization's Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety, and you watch their Vaccine Safety Summit from early December, it is truly shocking. It is truly, truly shocking, because behind closed doors, although there was a camera in the room, they say exactly what parents are saying the world over.
Right.
There's no proof that these vaccines in combination are safe. They have not tested the ingredients individually. They admit that they don't want to put adjuvants in vaccines, but they don't work if you don't put this sort of booster, which is used to be mercury. It's now aluminum. It's a known neurotoxin. They are, I thought they essentially admitted that sudden infant death syndrome is often a vaccine reaction, not so called. They admit that when people study on the internet what to do about vaccines, overwhelmingly 500% more people go to decide not to vaccinate than to vaccinate. They said that the label anti-vaxxer, which has been used now for 20 years at least, is pejorative, and they have to stop using it because people are, you know, they don't appreciate it. And they really said they're losing the physicians, and they can't afford that. That the physician front line is wobbly, and they can't afford that level of distrust in the program. So in essence, they admitted that the program is in trouble, and for good reason. And one of my favorites is the sort of the social kind of policy person is saying to the group, we need more science. We can't keep rolling out the same old retreads. We have to show them that it's safe. And you know, unfortunately, you sit back and you say, good luck with
that.
There
is no science.
Good luck with that. There, you know, there is not, and the science that they haven't done, Catherine, that the study that we've been asking them to do for at least 20 years, if not longer, show us the, you know, the prospective cohort study of unvaccinated children versus vaccinated children, and show us that those vaccinated children are, you know, wildly healthier than the unvaccinated. They've never produced that data, and you know what? It's absolutely likely that they've looked at that, and they know that they can't show that the vaccinated children are healthier. On the contrary, the vaccinated children have all of the side effects that you would predict from hypervaccination.
Right.
They have autoimmune issues, and they have neurological issues. And so they can't produce that science. And that's really you know, what is now becoming evident. They can't produce the real science because it doesn't exist. So they keep doctoring studies, and even, you know, the editors-in-chief of the New England Journal and the Journal of the American Medical Association, they say half of the stuff in our journal isn't true. They say there's undue influence by the pharmaceutical industry. But even they can't doctor studies sufficiently to really make the case that vaccines are what they claim them to be, safe and effective. And so then we see these extraordinary efforts at suppression. So I just was reading an article yesterday, you know, there's serious discussion in the United Kingdom about criminalizing speech that is considered anti-vaccine in print. I mean, this is the kind of things that are now being discussed, right? And in a place like New York, so children have been thrown since June. Children who had religious exemptions have been thrown out of school. They have been stigmatized remarkably. They have been truly stigmatized as if they were disease-ridden, which is an absolute fabrication. You know, I don't even know what my train of thought is, but this is crazy, right? This is now a new form of segregation, right? And it is based on nothing. It is the same kind of pseudoscience as eugenics, and there's a link there actually, but it is pseudoscience. There's no evidence that these children are bringing disease and somehow infecting the vaccinated, who are supposed to be protected anyway because vaccines are safe and effective.
Yeah, so if unvaccinated children can infect them, they clearly don't believe in the efficacy of their own vaccinations.
Right? Clearly. I mean, it's such a crazy notion. It's like all these kids have shields, right? And then you bring in a kid with no shield, and that's the child that is somehow the aggressor. I mean, it's crazy.
So let me ask a question, because about 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I would have said if you met a very well-educated, intelligent person, they just couldn't believe that the reality of vaccinations was so different than the, you know, what they'd been led to believe. So you have an official story, and they just couldn't believe that the gap between reality and official reality was that huge. Now what I see, because of the explosion of sort of the chronic, you know, an epidemic of chronic disease in American children, now what I see is I see thousands of highly educated and intelligent people who have come to the logical conclusion that the gap between reality and official reality is as extensive as it is. And to me, that's a real change. It's almost as though we've hit a tipping point.
Yes.
Is that your impression?
I think we're approaching the tipping point, Catherine. So I think what we're seeing globally is a level of a protest that we haven't seen in the last probably about 100 years around vaccines. So in the United States in the 1800s, there were riots about compulsory smallpox vaccines because they were super dangerous, right? Some people said, no, I'm gonna take my chances. I'm not going to take your dirty, your contaminated smallpox vaccine. So we're reaching that tipping point. So I was in New Jersey 2 weeks ago. I was in New Jersey in December and also in January, where crowds of thousands of people, many with their children, some grandparents, all people from all walks of life, from all racial backgrounds, of all religions, were gathered outside the legislative buildings and were chanting and making noise and protesting and giving cover to those legislators who would not sign on to a repeal of the religious exemption in New Jersey. And it's particularly significant because New Jersey is the home of, you know, in the United States, it's really the state that has the highest concentration of the pharmaceutical industry. Right. So I think we're seeing that there. There's a huge rally planned for Munich. So Germany, the homeland of the Nuremberg Code and the homeland of what were atrocious, you know, medical experimentation on human subjects during the war, they masterminded them. They have just introduced their first mandate since World War II, and that was a mandate for measles, and that's due to take effect in March, and there will be thousands and thousands of people congregating in Munich March 21st to 2nd to protest that. And I think, I don't think we've hit the tipping point yet. Sadly, I think that propaganda works. That's why, you know, industry and government do it. And I think a lot of highly educated people, particularly people in the medical establishment, sadly, really believe in the safety and efficacy. I think once you start to take it apart for people, you know, why is there this liability shield? How is it that unvaccinated children are the vectors of disease? You know, I think when you take it apart, you can kind of make headway, but, you know, this is a long embedded idea. And the notion of protecting children from, you know, discomfort and disease is, it's not a bad idea. It's not a bad idea at all. It's just that the way we're going about it clearly is, in to my mind, clearly is causing more harm than good. The chronic health epidemic in American children is horrifying. You know, 54% right. of American children have some kind of chronic disability. One in five has some kind of learning disability or neurological issue. You know, one in about 40, and maybe even more than that, has autism. These are really serious health conditions. And, right. you know, speaking of the money, in essence, what we see, you know, query whether this was the intent, but we know that vaccines cause autoimmune and neurological disorders disproportionately. And what are these chronic childhood epidemics that make lifelong customers for pharma? They're autoimmune conditions and they're neurological conditions. So, you know, this vaccine program, whether intentional or not, is leading to not just the profits on the vaccines, it's leading to profits indefinitely, you know, 10 times greater, 20 times greater than whatever money they made on the vaccines themselves.
Right. Right. I remember I was working with a reporter in the 90s and we did this fabulous chart because I was encountering in Tennessee teachers who were being put under tremendous pressure to say that a child was ADHD so that they could put the child on drugs when, in fact, the teacher didn't feel that way. You know, but they were working hard to get as many kids on the Ritalin and these other drugs. So I worked with this reporter to do a chart to show you how much the pharmaceutical company's stock would go up for every child they got on Ritalin. And that was only, and it was astonishing. I mean, you're talking about major improvement in the, you know, in the market capitalization for that company of this, these programs to dramatically increase the number of kids on Ritalin because it's an annuity. It's basically, you know, you get them on and then it's for life. And that's not even counting, you know, what then gets added. So now tell me, Mary, when you were talking with the legislators in the different states you've been working with, when they argue against your position, when they come out for the pharmaceutical company position, what do they say? What are they most concerned about?
So their first response is, we believe the doctors, right? Doctors and scientists are trained in this area, and there are legions of physicians who are telling us that these products are safe and effective for all children. And so, you know, this is, they're telling us this is the best way to prevent infectious disease. Then sort of almost a little bit at odds with that, they say, we know that there are some immunocompromised children. We know that there are some children who are on chemotherapy, for instance, because they're being treated for childhood cancer, and those children can't be vaccinated while they're on chemo. And so we have to have everybody be immune from getting these diseases because of those immunocompromised children. And then their third major argument is the theory of herd immunity and the theory that if everybody is vaccinated, even though they will admit that not every person who gets a vaccine will in fact become immune, if everybody's vaccinated, then we have our best shot at protecting the community from having an outbreak of measles or mumps or whatever it is, pertussis. And they call it sort of in a more friendly way, community immunity. Those are the primary arguments that they use.
So we see more and more parents and more practitioners objecting. Why is their voice not effective? Because it's very, very strong.
Well, it's becoming more effective, Catherine. So in New Jersey, you know, in Pharma's home territory, twice now, families have been able to push back and keep that from happening. And so Connecticut's legislature is starting its session on Wednesday. And I think there's a lot of activity that's planned in Connecticut. And there's hearings planned in Connecticut for February 19th. There's a referendum in Maine that's going to take place in March to decide whether or not the repeal of the religious exemption should go through. It's like a plebiscite. They have that law in Maine. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of activity in California. There's litigation going on in California. There's litigation going on in New York. So I think what we've seen is that the states where these repeals have had most traction or gone through are states that are a trifecta, right? They have one right. party control of the whole state. Basically, in states where there has been two parties, the bills have not gotten so far.
Has there been any interest or concern in the bar or the legal community that you have a basic violation of the Constitution or the Nuremberg Code? And so they may not be particularly interested in vaccination, but a violation that is this sort of extraordinary threatens many, many different areas.
Right. Well, I think we're starting to see civil rights lawyers understand the issue more. So, for instance, in New York, a civil rights lawyer who had worked on segregation and housing and had worked on criminal defendants' rights for many years, he understood this issue that the repeal of the religious exemption was an affront to any concept of civil rights. This is kind of a new form of segregation against healthy children. So right. we've seen lawyers starting to step up, but it's surprising. I think there has over time been this carve out around vaccines that is extraordinary to you and me, but somehow it's been a creeping concept that, well, this is a carve out and it's okay to have coercion for vaccines. It's no problem. I don't know where that idea comes from, but honestly, but that has been somehow accepted with the rhetoric that, well, they're safe and effective for everybody. I mean, when you think about it, is there any ingestible or any medication that's safe and effective for everybody? I don't know of it. It's not milk. It's not wheat. It's not penicillin. It's not aspirin. I don't know any drug or any food for that matter that is safe and effective for everyone. And yet that's the rhetoric that still flies when it comes to vaccines.
Well, if you look at let's just look at the money for a second. If you look at decades, the extraordinary amount of the profits that are being generated by the healthcare industry and by pharmaceutical companies, and how much of that rolls into what I would call as a kickback scheme for political contributions and other forms of income to people in government and politics. It was your colleague, Mr. Kennedy, who educated me to the fact that the CDC has got the ultimate conflict of interest. They're making money from their patents and their own financial interest in this, you know, in vaccination. Right. So you have an extraordinary compromising of government, politicians, doctors, and then in addition, if you look at the extent to which pharmaceutical and drug ads support the media industry, you know, the conflicts of interest are very, very significant and been going on for a long time.
Right.
And when everybody is sort of on the dole, if you're running a kickback scheme that is this extraordinary and this corrupt, at some point you don't want to admit what you've been doing. It's very hard to roll it back.
I agree. Yeah. I mean, it reminds me in some sense, I spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union and I sort of came to understand in some ways how it worked for a long time, but after 70 years it collapsed. And the party was everywhere, right? The party was everywhere. It was in the institutions, it was in the schools, it was in industry, it was the government. The Communist Party had to be everywhere. And ironically, although the pharmaceutical industry is not the only dominant industry in the Western world, it is a very, very dominant one, and it has unique access to government. It really, through departments of health and through immunization national programs, it has unique access to governments. And you're right, you know, so the media is 70% funded by the pharmaceutical industry. It's not just the CDC that holds patents. For instance, the National Institute of Health, I did a right. deep dive with colleagues on the Gardasil vaccine. They hold the patent for the Gardasil vaccine. We know that Gardasil is the second highest earner for the U.S. government from its patent royalties, and yet it's under the same umbrella, Health and Human Services, where they're supposed to decide who's been injured by Gardasil. I mean, it's an extraordinary conflict of interest, and literally the head of the Autism Interagency Coordinating Committee back in the day, they had authorized a tiny amount of money for federal doles, $5 million to investigate whether vaccines caused autism. And the guys, he defunded that, the head of it, who at the time was the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, saying, this would be a conflict of interest for us. We recommend all these products. It would be a conflict for us to fund science that might be helpful to plaintiffs in the, you know, in the injury compensation program. So, I mean, right. there is an explicit conflicts of interest here.
In our 2019 annual wrap-up, I put up, and I at the time I said, you know, I think this is one of the greatest political speeches of the decade. I put up the speech that Robert Kennedy gave coming out of the California legislature after they'd essentially lost. And one of the things he said, and I thought this was absolutely chilling, he said that one of the legislatures had said to him, if you keep this up, Bobby, you won't have any friends. And he said in front of the crowd, he said, you know, I told him, I have a lot of friends. And I thought that was very effective because one of the things you would hear in Washington and Wall Street all the time was if you buck us on this one, you won't have any friends. I can't tell you what a great effective threat that always was to sort of corral and herd the troops. And I thought the way he sort of teed that up and killed it was beautiful, but you could feel the chilling coercion that comes with these efforts.
So what has happened? Yes. I mean, I think Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the chair of Children's Health Defense, has been just an extraordinary gift to the parental community that wants to have their own informed consent over what goes into their children's bodies. He's been, you know, outspoken and he doesn't pull punches, right? He's been really, really explicit in the fraud that's involved in this, and in essence the heist of health and the heist of money from families around this vaccine program. But I think on the friends issue, it's fascinating. So what we saw in New Jersey, for instance, is there's a very dominant president of the Senate, and we watched twice in December and January as he tried to browbeat junior Democrats and threatened to punish them if they voted against the party's decision to repeal the religious exemption. And after it didn't pass the second time, he in fact took away the chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee from Senator Lagana, who voted against him as a Democrat.
Wow.
And they tried to enforce other penalties against their party members who did not toe the line. So much for sort of legislators being able to vote their conscience. They're not when it comes to a party priority. And they're punished if they vote their conscience or they vote the way their constituents really require them to vote. But what was very interesting in New Jersey, Catherine, is that the Democratic legislators who voted against the bill, the Democrats, with one exception, with maybe a couple exceptions, but several of them were African American. And what we're seeing now is that African American legislators have a better understanding of this often than the sort of mainstream or Caucasian legislators. The African Americans understand is like, if you're going to start throwing children out of school and segregating them on this basis, where is that going to stop? And isn't this the same rhetoric that they used against Jews and against African Americans? You know, they're dirty, they're diseased, they're, you know, vermin. And we see all of that stigmatization going on. I was with a mom the other day whose children have been thrown out of a religious school, a Catholic school. And, you know, the school administrators are saying, oh, they have to fumigate the school if she were to come. I mean, you know, really treating these people as if they are walking disease spreaders, which is so ironic because in truth, the unvaccinated are the healthiest among us. They have fully intact immune systems that work the way our creator, you know, made them.
So I want to talk a little bit about money now, because I have worked through with numerous families the cost of having anywhere from a mildly autistic to heavily autistic child. Mm-hmm. And not just the economics of what it's going to cost them in times and money, mm-hmm. but in fact, what it costs the other siblings, what it costs right. in terms of divorce and impact right. on the family.
Right.
So the financial expense to the family is extraordinary, to everybody in the family and the often the extended family. And yet there doesn't seem to be, there seems to be a complete disinterest from the companies, the legislators promoting this. In other words, the pharmaceutical companies get the profits, the government gets the profits, but the families and the neighbors and the extended family get the expenses.
Well, I don't even think, I think that the state governments are saddling the costs, right? So we have this federal injury compensation program that Congress created in 1986. And in theory, it's going to cover the expenses of people who are injured by vaccines. But there's a very short statute of limitations. It's very limited what they actually, you know, will compensate. And, you know, 2/3 of the cases lose. You know, there's an extraordinary range of things that are wrong with that program. But then the states through Medicaid are saddled with these expenses. And if you read about what's right. going on with schools and special education now, I mean, it's unbelievable, right? I mean, you know, there's padded rooms and there's special classes. I was just reading about the school district where I went, and they said when I was there, maybe there was like one special needs classroom out of 1,600 children. There were six, and they say that now they need 13. I mean, 13 special needs classrooms. This is an extraordinary expense to the educational system. And then the adult, the tidal wave that's coming that the states are completely unprepared for, right? It's the, since 1989, when the vaccine program really started to ramp up after the liability protection was put in place, those people are now just hitting adulthood. And as you point out, their life care plans are millions of dollars, and states and families, of course, in the first instance, and charities, but beyond that, it's the state. And honestly, I don't know what's going to happen, because many of these young adults are now severely, severely injured. They're nonverbal. Many right. of them are not potty trained. Many of them are violent. That's part of the neurological injury. And it's very, you know, many of them require 24/7 care. And unless we stop this craziness and keep injuring people, I don't know what's going to happen, Catherine. I mean, I do lose sleep over it. It's like, how is the society going to cope? It's a very frightening thought. It's a very frightening thought. And when you see that we're violating Nuremberg, and then you remember that where the Holocaust really started was killing special needs children. German children is where it started. They started by killing special needs German right. children. You know, it's a very chilling thought. There are some very uncomfortable parallels right now between what's happening in the U.S. around medicine and what happened in Germany before, you know, when the Nazis were taking over. The, right. the medical community collaborated. And I'm very frightened, because we have a percentage of adults coming of age who will not be able to support themselves or contribute to the society in a financial way.
Right. Right. And I think it's not just kids who are heavily autistic and so can't be productive in the workplace, but when you look at the numbers of 60%+ children with chronic disease, you're talking about a highly unproductive
correct
group of people.
Correct.
You know, with tremendous stress on the healthcare system. If you look at the cost, you know, we're we cost more per person, almost double than
Right. Now.
the next most expensive country, I think, which is Switzerland. So, and that's before this sort of
Right.
bulge moves through the through through moves
Exactly.
through the age group.
Exactly. It's really truly frightening. One of the people who's now consulting with Children's Health Defense is named Toby Rogers, and he just completed a PhD in Australia on the political economy of autism. And he was just on Dell Bigtree's High Wire reviewing the actual costs of autism. But of course, vaccine injury is so much broader than just autism. That's literally the tip of the iceberg.
Right.
It is the ADHD,
Right.
it is the juvenile arthritis, it is the juvenile diabetes, it is, by far, it is the asthma. It is so broad of the things that are likely connected to vaccines that have, where the connection has been obscured.
Right, and then all the opportunity costs to the family when those things occur within it.
Oh,
So let's talk about what people can do to help, because I think there are many different actions that someone can take. The first, and I think, is to keep the revenues flowing. I always say, I'm always qu quoting Roger Penske, "Speed costs money. How fast do you want to go?" And if you look at the extent to which we're all financing the lobbyists and law firms and companies and governments that are doing this, I think part of it, I believe, is we need to start switching our cash flows to the people who are truly representing us. So one thing they can do is to support you. We regularly give little donations and publicize them on the blog, and your group is
Thank you.
always at the top of the list.
Thank you.
But I would encourage everybody to go to childrenshealthdefense.org and sign up, make a donation. What else can they do to support?
Well, we're an educational institution. We don't officially take positions on any bills. We support people to make informed health choices, but we provide a lot of information about vaccines. We're getting more generally involved in other threats to childhood and human health, including the wireless industry and health effects of that, glyphosate, pesticides in food. We're getting involved more broadly, but the vaccines has really been our focus, in part because most other institutions aren't willing to take that on. But the other things people can do is every state at this point has a health choice organization. Scour Facebook, look on the internet. You'll find that there is a group in your state. We're starting to form state chapters, but we only have a few. There are some what's called health choice state chapters. You can look at the health choice. National Vaccine Information Center also has state chapters effectively and leaders. The National Vaccine Information Center has a legislative portal, which is very useful. And you go into the portal and you find out what are the pending bills in your state that have implications for vaccines, and it tells you whether they recommend that you support it or oppose it as somebody who's concerned about informed consent for vaccines. You want to give some love to the politicians who are taking your position. We're
Oh,
seeing
yes.
that now more. It's very important that if you see a politician who's standing up and says, "I support informed consent, I support parental rights, I support bodily integrity around these issues," we need to support those people because it does take
Absolutely.
effort and courage for them to stand up against the pharmaceutical industry. And basically, they're not going to get funded, and their own party may be up against them. And other things people can do, so literally what happened in New Jersey is just thousands of parents converged, and they made it clear, we won't accept this. We will vote you out. One of our chants was, "We will vote you out."
So this is a campaign year, so most politicians or many politicians have campaigns this year. And I find showing up at the town hall meeting and making your voice heard about this and making it clear that you will not tolerate
I mean,
violations of the Nuremberg Code is, to me, is very, very important
It
to
is
do.
very important. And I think really letting legislators know, I in general am not a one-issue voter, but on this, I'm a one-issue voter. You may not separate me from my child. You may not deprive me and my child of our independent healthcare decision-making. It's so fundamental. It's like if they can force you to inject aluminum in your body to go to school, well, how are you going to know what's in that particular vial? You're not going to know.
Right.
It's really an extraordinary overreach, governmental overreach.
So to me, I'll be even stronger because it is health freedom, but it's freedom. In other words,
it's freedom. I agree with
you.
Is
my body my own? Is my house my own?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, if my body's not mine, there are no property rights at all.
I completely agree. And it's interesting. One of the legislators in New Jersey made the point, he's a criminal defense lawyer, and he said, you know, if there is a homicide, if there's an accident driving, and potentially a drunk driver kills somebody else on the road, so it's called vehicular homicide. In that circumstance, to get a blood test from that person to quote unquote pierce the skin requires a warrant from a judge. That requires real due process to get that. And yet our children are lined up as if this was Kool-Aid. It's not Kool-Aid. And I agree with you. If you don't control your own body, you don't control anything.
Right. Right. Especially if somebody's putting in things which have been proven beyond
proven to be dangerous.
So one last thing, Mary, because I know from understanding and reading your history, you know what, I call it the shriek-o-meter. There is a, you know, whether it's the lobbyists or the media, there is a bullying culture and mentality in this country when people are politically trying to force something which is contradictory to our basic principles. So you really have to go up against quite a machinery of lies and spin.
Right.
And yet you have done this for decades very, very effectively, and you seem not the worse for wear. So how do we deal with that kind of bullying?
You know, honestly, one of the ways I deal with it is I don't go out of my way to make myself aware of all the bullying. If somebody writes a nasty piece about me, you know, my friends will tell me and maybe I'll go read the really nasty piece. But, you know, the day-to-day sort of harassment that happens on Twitter and on, you know, the internet, I don't read those things. I find that they're drivel to me. It's just talking points from the industry and I don't waste my time on it. And that protects me, candidly. I don't really need to know what ORAC has to say, or what Gorski has to say on a regular basis, or what Dorit Rice says. Sometimes I think they're interesting points, or Art Kaplan, you know, but basically I see those people as spokespeople for industry and I know what their talking points are. I'm not going to envelop myself in what is really, it's vitriol. It's toxic and I do avoid it personally. And you know, I do have lots of friends. It's an extraordinary movement. I have to say, it's a really profound movement to me because I can disagree with many, many people in this movement on many, many issues. But on this issue, we are just so, there is such solidarity. It's like, there's nothing to, our species is named after the relationship between a mother and a child. It's a mammal, right? It's the act of breastfeeding. It's like, if you cast asunder the relationship between a parent and a child, it's all over. That's what the species is about. And so on this issue, I don't care if I disagree with people about 1,000 other issues. I am so delighted to stand in solidarity with that parent on this issue. And there's something so beautiful about people protecting their children. That's what this is really about.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, it gets back to every value that you've ever been taught was representative of Western values. If we're going to have vaccine mandates throughout the United States, then there is no such thing as Western values. You know, we've just taken all of them and deleted them.
I think that the only thing that made the vaccine mandates arguably legitimate for the last 50 years was the existence of religious exemptions. Taking them away makes these mandates absolutely uncontrovertibly an abuse of power.
Right. And a change of to me, it's a change of your entire governance structure and system.
This is not,
you're not a constitutional republic.
I agree. This is not freedom. If you don't control what goes into your bloodstream, you are not free. It is far broader than health freedom. It is freedom itself.
Right. And as you said, this is, we're talking about heavy metals that go straight to the brain. We're not talking about Kool-Aid.
Right. We know that, you know, there are things in the vaccines that cross the blood-brain barrier. And we know from autopsies that people who are severely autistic, for example, have high concentrations of aluminum in the brain. We know so much now, Catherine. This is not 150 years ago. And we have so many other ways to deal with measles, with vitamin A, or to get through a rash with the mumps. This is just so crazy. These are essentially mild childhood illnesses. There's so much evidence that, for instance, it is the vaccinated with pertussis who are transmitting and causing the outbreaks. We have the evidence that the mumps component doesn't work. That's why we're seeing outbreaks in fully vaccinated populations. Measles is, you know, it's, we know that the vaccine is not entirely affected. We know that some people aren't going to get immunity. We know that there's asymptomatic transmission. We know so much more than we knew in the past that it makes it just, this is an unsustainable program. And really the question in my mind is how long is it going to take for us to end it? That's really the question. The writing's on the wall. I lived through the end of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Berlin Wall. This is a system that doesn't work. It's going to fall apart. The only question is how long is it going to take?
Right. I agree with you. There was, I just did a book review about a year ago of a book. I think it was called The Autism Vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Is it The Autism Project or the Autism Vaccine?
I don't know that
one. I have to look it up. It's quite extraordinary because one of the, it was the only vaccine book I've ever read that had no anger in it. It was very mm-hmm. peacefully done.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if I can find it. And it was beautifully written.
Oh,
just
great.
Extraordinary. Wait a minute. Let me see. And but the way it ended up, let me just get it. It was The Autism Vaccine by The Story of Modern Medicine's Greatest Tragedy. It's
by
Forrest.
Forrest
McGreedy. Writer.
Forrest McGreedy.
Yeah,
he's an excellent
he's the author
writer.
Of The Moth and the Iron Lung. And
yeah.
Crook. Yeah.
Yeah, super.
Beautiful,
super.
Beautiful book.
Oh, good. I'll read it.
Oh, but what it makes clear at the end is that the, you know, it's almost as though it took forever to start the storm. But now you have this storm of parents and practitioners who cannot be stopped.
Right.
And he says the same thing you say. It's simply a matter of time because, you know, this will not last.
This will not blow over.
Right. It reminds me, have you ever heard the story of the island of California, the map of the island of California?
No.
You can look it up on the internet. In the 1500s, someone made a map of the west coast of the United States, and they made California an island that you could sail around.
Hmm.
Clearly the map was wrong. Mm-hmm. And it became essentially the official map of the Spanish explorers. Hmm. And everybody insisted that they had sailed around the Isle of California. Of course, they were lying. But you had all these famous explorers who were then committed to the lie. And finally, it took the king.
Wow.
So many people were landing and then trying to carry their boats over the mountain so they could sail across the Bay of California, which of course didn't exist anyway, but it took an act of the king to say, kill the map.
Wow.
Because
that's
so many people were caught up in the lies.
Yeah, there's a lot of people caught up in this lie.
If there is anything that the Soleri Report or I or the Soleri team or our subscribers can do to help, we definitely would love to do it, and especially state by state. You know, if I'll tell people to look at where you have chapters, or the other organization that has local chapters is called Health Choice.
Health Choice has many state chapters. They're an excellent group. I'm on their advisory board. But I'm happy to stay in touch with you. Right now, the state that's really under the microscope is Connecticut. So the festivities start in Connecticut tomorrow. And so that's the state right now to watch. Although New Jersey and New York are still sort of very much in play, what's going to happen for the remainder of the legislative season. And then there's this referendum in Maine coming up. Those are some of the key things that are going on legislatively right now.
Okay, well, Mary, you're doing great stuff, and we look forward to keeping up with you and supporting, and I just say thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
You're doing something that's important to every person, whether because this is health freedom, and this is freedom.
Yep, may I ask a question? Will I be able to get a link to this? Is that possible? Can we publicize
the interview?
Yes, and
if you would
like,
normally our interviews are subscriber only, but if we think there's an important public purpose, we'll make it public. And if you would like, I'll make this public right away.
I think we would love that, and we'll put it, and then we'll attract people. If you give us a blurb about how people can join to be a subscriber, we'll be happy to. Okay. Well, I don't know. I have to ask my media team, but we could probably at least give you credit for it.
Don't worry about that. We'll make it public, and
we can link to it.
Report.
Well, that'd be super. Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm grateful to have had the chance to speak.
Okay, and you're right. Okay. I bet you do have a lot of friends.
We do.
You have a great day.
Thank you. You too.